James, chapter 2, verse 14 through 26, the sixth talk in a series on the book of James, was presented by Rusty Rexius on January 15, 2017, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2017. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Let's see, since I was here last, I've been to Israel, as some of you in the room have. I still plan to go back. We had an election. We will soon have a new president. We had a losing football season. We have a new coach. We have a great basketball team. We may win a national championship. But as far as I can tell, our Bibles haven't changed. So I am going to continue to talk about what I was talking about before. I don't actually remember when it was, April or May, I think, in the book of James. Got a little ways through a chapter and a half or so. So I'm going to pick that up again. And I won't get very far, I'm sure of that. I think, as I said the last time I stood up here, it doesn't seem to bother people around here that the pace is incredibly slow, because that's exactly how my pace is in this. So I'm going to do something today that I've actually never done before. I realized as I was studying that there is a whole host of things, most importantly in the background of the folks that James is actually speaking to, but a whole host of things that are just going in my head that I think I understand are going on in the background 2,000 years ago. And I realize that if you don't know that, there's no way you or me can come to understand what in the world James is talking about. And some of that just seems obvious. We talk here a lot about context and background, and so I know that's not a new concept. But it just dawned on me that there's so much that's being assumed that I just needed to take a shot at running through those assumptions here. So in a way, I'm going to try to tell the biblical story in about 20 minutes or so. Well, I actually have no idea how long it's going to take, but I'm guessing around there, in order to set up the background that I think we absolutely have to know, in particular with this passage that we're going to look at today. Because if we don't understand it, I am convinced we will go quite afar from what James was trying to tell the folks that he was speaking to. So a lot of it is going to be review, probably most of it for a lot of you. Some of it maybe you've never heard before, and so I hope that's helpful. Before I do that, though, let me take only a few minutes to just a teeny bit of background into James, the book itself. I won't go through all of the detail that I did the last time, but this is written, I think I may have changed my mind a little bit on this. It's written somewhere between 40 and 60 AD. So Jesus is gone, and now the apostles are the ones left telling his story. Pretty convinced that it's written by James, the brother of Jesus. There are options, but I just see no reason to go with those other options. This is James, the brother of Jesus. Since Jesus left, incidentally, James didn't want anything to do with his brother when his brother was here on earth telling his story. James figured out that his brother wasn't such a lunatic, and so he decided maybe he was worth listening to, ultimately became an apostle, not one of the original 12, but later an apostle, and in the end becomes the undisputed leader of the Jerusalem church. So we've got arguably the most prominent Jew in the land, and he's overseeing, I don't know if they called it a church or not, but the synagogue in Jerusalem. I wish I could say that I'd been there and walked in it. I haven't, and I didn't. I don't think they know where that was. But in any case, James was the undisputed leader of the church in Jerusalem. And he was a decision maker for much of the budding church. When questions arose about what you did or didn't need to do or be as a believer, James was the one, and others in Jerusalem, but James was the one that you would go to ask. We know that because that's what Paul did. Paul went to James to ask about what it was that he was saying and whether that was correct or not to say that. There are a couple of theories about the structure of James. The one I've landed on is something that is called either a Yalkut or a Yalkut. I don't know. I don't think this is a letter that James penned. It could be, and if it is, it doesn't hurt anything. But I think what this is James preaching in his synagogue. I am convinced that he's preaching in the synagogue, as was the custom for every rabbi in a synagogue, to go through Torah and take sections of Torah and teach on them. I think this portion of, or James, is preaching about a section in Leviticus, Leviticus 19, and what we have are his comments about that. We don't have his exegesis of Leviticus. We have the implications of Leviticus. And what I think happened was that James did his Torah preaching. That was totally normal in the time. And then through either afterwards or through the week when the synagogue was still open, James was talking about the implications of that within the belief of the church. What did that mean? What did that imply? What were they to do with the fact that they were these Jewish believers in Jerusalem? And like we're recording, they were scribing those sermons that James gave. And so as time went on, the circumstances around the region presented itself where James or James's apostles or somebody said, you know, James, that stuff that you're talking about, that'd be incredibly helpful for everybody else. All the other Jews in the diaspora, or the diaspora, however you want to say that, the Jews all over the place would be benefited a great deal, James, from what you're talking about. Let's put this stuff together and send it out, which is what I think we have. I think it is a compilation of James' sermons, James' comments, James' thoughts, James' beliefs about what it means to be a believer in a Jewish world. And that's where it dawned on me that there are a set of assumptions, a long set of assumptions, that the Jewish world that our believers are operating from, 2,000 or so years of history that they're working with, a whole culture that they've grown up in, that they're steeped in, and we don't know any of it, or very little of it. But importantly, as Jews living the lives of Jews, there are things that they are just assuming in the background. James knows that they're assuming that, and he doesn't spell it out at all. He's just talking about the implications of what they now believe of those things that they all just know. So what I've done is tried to take a shot at what I think these Jewish believers just know, and that we're supposed to understand as James is speaking to the implications of belief in Jesus to those things. So let me just walk you through this, and I hope this is helpful. Some preliminary thoughts, just with respect specifically to James, to set this up. I do think there's an unmistakable flow to the book of James. I don't think it's just a random sort of shot at the wall as to just important things to know about. There is a flow, and here's where the flow comes from. It's sort of in backwards order. James 1:22 says, "Be sure you live out the message, and do not merely listen to it so as to deceive yourselves." So live out the message. Well, what's the message? James 1:18 says that by his sovereign plan, he gave us birth through the message of truth, that we would be the kind of first fruits of all that he created. So what is it that comes to this first fruits via this message of truth? Well, James 1:12 says, "Happy is the one who endures testing, because when he is proven to be genuine, he will receive the crown of life that God promised to those who love him." James says that those who are proven to be genuine, I think it's genuine in their belief, that will receive the crown of life, the promise. So if I'm reading this right, virtually everything that James writes is with this question in the background. Are you genuine that you might receive the crown of life? Nothing else matters. Nothing else matters. James and his parishioners, it's probably not what they were called, find themselves in circumstances, many of them, that are calling into question the genuineness of what they say they believe. But what James has not really spelled out, not for us anyway, is exactly what it is they believe in. That's what we don't know, or at least not yet. This, I think, we must assume is clear, as I've just said, very clear to those he's speaking to, but we have to learn it elsewhere, and we learn it from the Bible, the whole Bible. Now, understanding the whole Bible is a whole life's work, I know that, probably many lives' works. But to understand what James is driving at, it seems to me that we absolutely need to get our heads around two things that he is speaking to and he's writing into that they have no explanation needed. They're just living with this knowledge. So number one, what they just know. From the beginning of time, at least the beginning of human time, God has interacted with those that he's created. Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, Enoch, Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth. Each and every one of these people were given one and only one instruction for life. Do precisely what God says, and it will go well for you. But then along comes one particular man that, while he didn't exactly know it, God was setting the whole course of human history through this human man. That man was Abraham from the Ur of Chaldees. There's a whole lot to say about Abraham, and I'm not going to say it all, but for now, what must be said is that God interacted with Abraham in very much the same way he did with all the people before him. He said to Abraham, "Believe me and do precisely as I say, and it will go well for you." But to Abraham, different from everybody else, to Abraham, God also said, "I'm doing something very special in you, Abraham. I'm establishing a relationship with you unlike any other that I've ever established. I'm going to do things in you and in your family that have simply never been done before. In fact, the reason I created everything, all things, will be played out in you and in your family. I ask one and only one thing, that you believe what I say and that you do exactly what I ask you to do. If you will just do that, just believe and do, it will go extraordinarily well for you, you and all of your family to follow." And mostly, Abraham believed what God said and did what God asked. But the extraordinarily well part, that part that would go so well for him, some of that occurred. But much of what Abraham was expecting, he never got to see. Same for his son Isaac, same for his son Jacob, same for the rest of the sons. For the most part, in spite of what they didn't see, they still believed. And mostly they continued to do what God had asked. But then as time went on and as history played out, it looked like things would not go so well for the people of God and those that God had chosen to interact with. Over time, through circumstances, many of which were well beyond their control, they found themselves in a place where it would be hard to know, and certainly hard to see, how it was that this God who came to their father Abraham was ever going to bless them as he promised. For now, they were slaves in Egypt. 400 years later, God had forgotten them. Our audience in James just knows that. The second thing that they just knew was that something extremely significant happened at the end of that 400 years. The course of human history changed again. God reemerged. He raised up Moses, and the interaction was in play again. God said to Moses almost exactly what he'd said to Abraham several hundred years prior, "Believe what I say and do precisely what I ask for you, and it will go well for you and all those whom you represent." And just like Abraham, there is much to say about Moses, but eventually Moses did believe God, and he did precisely as God had asked him to do. And it mostly went well for him and for them, with some hiccups along the way. But with Moses, God did something very different than he did with Abraham. With Moses, God painted a much clearer picture of what exactly he wanted and how exactly he wanted that to play out. We call that the Ten Commandments, Torah, or the law. And again, there is much to say about this law that was given to Moses, in the people for which he stood. But at least two things, I think, were to come out of this important piece of history that are relevant to James and what his audience knew. Number one, this really was how God wanted this people to live. There was no ambiguity, there was no question. God was telling the people what to believe in and what exactly to do. And if they did, it would go well for them. If you don't, it won't. And the second thing that is important to bit of history that's relevant to James is while believing and doing those things that God said exactly what they were supposed to do, an incredibly important lesson was to be learned. A lesson that defined life and it defined death. While one could believe in each and every one of the things that God had said and actually do each and every thing that God was requiring them to do, one would inevitably find themselves believing and doing almost resentfully, and doing so with a heart of rebellion towards the one who made the requirements, and the one who made the promise, and the one who would bring the blessing. When one came to understand this, that is, one's natural rebellion against the promiser, one simply could not help but ask a question. So is this certain? Is it absolutely certain that I can and I will receive this blessing of ours that God has promised in spite of what I've now come to understand myself to be? And to further beg that question that I think inevitably was to occur within what God had provided with his instructions, he provided a means by which one would be forced to ask how one could know this blessing from their God could ever be secure, a way to both learn about and cry out for mercy. That is, mercy for being a rebel I now have come to understand that I am. For rebels, left unto themselves, they don't receive blessings, not from the one that they are in rebellion against. And that particular way, that unique way, that different way that God had provided to teach them was what we call the Levitical priesthood. The systems of offerings and sacrifices and pleas to God for forgiveness, for mercy, for not being what was clear God wanted. That is, a people with hearts that were sold out to their God. And there, again, is so much to say about this system. But I am convinced that the reason, the telos of what God had provided, had one goal. It had one outcome. It had one ultimate, that is, for the one practicing it. If not that priest who's offering that bull or that goat or that dove or that ram, if that's not how I receive mercy, then how? How will it work? And with so much to say, nor time nor space, it right now, the answer to that most ultimate question that ever was Jesus. Jesus could and Jesus would ensure that what God had promised would fall upon those whom he'd promised it to. Jesus, the one who came and announced he was the long-awaited Messiah, the anointed one, the King of Israel, would serve another previously unknown and certainly little understood role. He would act as a worthy priest to enter into the actual presence of God, bringing a sacrifice God would be certain to accept himself. This is what the people in James understood. Jesus, in the most heroic act in all of human history, would offer himself, the chosen one, the future king of Israel, to suffer and die. That he would go himself before God, not in a temple made with hands, but into the actual presence of God. And he'd beg for mercy for those who could not and would not find mercy in any other way. And the requirement for receiving this mercy, that is the means by which one could access this true forgiveness from God to receive the promised blessing, simply believe that Jesus was exactly who he said he was, doing precisely what he said he would do, and then do exactly what he said to do, living with unending thankfulness and gratitude for God's willingness to accept me, in spite of every reason why he shouldn't, and that is thanks to Jesus. And as a result, the mercy one stands to receive from God on behalf of Jesus, rightly understood, cannot help but produce two results. One, profound gratitude towards God, which is summed up in the verse that says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And number two, an inescapable compunction to show grace and mercy towards other. And that we find in love your neighbors as yourself. As a side note, I'm not sure of the exegesis of this, but I think that love your neighbor as yourself would better be said, love your neighbor as you yourself are loved. That makes a lot more sense to me. And another way to say those two things, love the Lord your God, or profound gratitude and inescapable compunction to show grace and mercy towards other, another way to just say that is believe God and do what he says. This whole story, in about 20 minutes, is the gospel, the true message. That's what James and all the other apostles had come to know and later teach. And this is what one was to entrust one's entire life to, and what one accepted when he or she became a Jesus follower, a believer, Christ one. For the Jewish person, remember, that's who's listening, not us Gentiles. For a Jewish person, in one respect, his whole world was turned upside down. Now, rather than temple priests and bloody animals trying to secure forgiveness and blessing, Jesus had done that. He'd done it all, and that was life-changing. And that is precisely what they were to believe. But one thing had not changed, and it never had, and I don't think it ever will. One must still, in his belief or her belief in what God had said, including now Jesus, do exactly what God had said to do. And one would do so with gratitude and with thankfulness and with love, for Jesus had secured for them what they could never have been secured in before, the blessing of God, the promises made to by their forefathers and to their forefathers. He'd secured life. But Jesus had not come to replace all those things that for centuries the Jews had come to learn that were utterly important. No, he didn't come to replace it. Rather, he came to fulfill them. He came to fill them in, to put them into context, to give them the reason and the meaning and the import. And most importantly, Jesus should intensify and highlight and elevate one's desire for doing anything and everything that could possibly show gratitude and thankfulness towards God. And for the Jew, those to whom God is actually speaking to, that all would happen right within the context of this law, this Torah, that he or she had been given by God. The thing is, they were still required to do it, just like they always had been and just like they always will be. But now doing comes from believing. But something critical had been added, something inescapable and irreplaceable, indispensable. Jesus, in all that he had said and done, came alongside, and it filled in everything that God had already put into place. Remember, Jesus said in Matthew, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill it. So what was the Jesus-believing Jew to actually do? What was different? What would he or she do that he or she wasn't already doing? This, it seems to me, is the real question behind the book of James. It was certainly not to stop doing what God had given them, that is, the law, to do. Maybe they were to stop doing the sacrifices, but given that there was no temple, it wasn't really an option anyway. So at least as I understand it, the way the Jew was to go about living was actually exactly the same, doing the things that God had given them to do. But with a fast-forward look into the passage in James that we're going to actually look at today, the doing he is speaking about, it simply cannot be in reference to either doing or not doing law or Torah. That makes no sense. And it would be unthinkable for the Jew of that day, Jesus believing or not, to even consider putting the law aside. I suppose there could be one or two that would actually entertain that thought, maybe, but that just can't be the works that James is going to be speaking about shortly. So ultimately, the law is not what is in question. They were all doing law as they had been and should have been. So while doing law, what is it that a Jesus-believing Jew, on account of what Jesus said and did, what would they do differently than his non-believing Jewish neighbor? And, as another side note, I think a critical side note, the answer to this question, that is, what would the believing do different from the non-believing Jew? The answer to that question, it seems to me, is where we, as Gentile believers in Jesus, that's where we fit in. It's the same answer for us, I think. I have an acronym here. And how the Jesus-believing Jew answers this question is exactly how the Jesus-believing Gentile would answer this question. So what is different? What should they be doing differently? What's the different do? And I'm not sure actually that's exactly the right question. Because back to the ultimate question, the one I had at the very beginning, the one that James asked at the very beginning, it's not so much what's the different do, but it's rather, are you genuine? Are you genuine? So the answer to the immediate question, what's the different do, may be the wrong question. Maybe the more appropriate question is, are you or are you not genuine? And secondarily, is that answer different, are you genuine, pre and post Jesus? So let me take just a couple of seconds to respond to that, and then we'll actually get into the text. Ultimately, the answer, I think, is really pretty simple. One knows whether he or she is genuine, at least with respect to God, if he or she constantly or consistently and faithfully responds favorably to what God declares. Another way to say it might be a favorable pattern of response to what God says. Looking back, that simply meant you did precisely as God has had instructed as a pattern, and it would go well for you. And how exactly did that play out in the course of life that God had orchestrated? You acted on what you believed God to be saying. That's how you were genuine. And certainly that included, when we get to Moses, following precisely his instructions. But that's not all it included. As we'll see later in this text, with the person of Abraham and the person of Rahab, we would see in every other character in the Bible, if we look closely, is that genuineness is played out by responding to whatever God says. Importantly, if you believed, you acted on belief, and that was genuine. But along comes Jesus, and God says something just a little bit different. This is what I was talking about a minute ago. Jesus said all the same things that God had said for centuries, but he said that behind all of that, behind everything God had been saying for centuries, there's a message. There's a message of truth, a blessing, the promise of mercy and forgiveness, life, and that comes through me, Jesus. Remember, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by or through me. So it all boils down to one thing, believe in me, Jesus. So how does one measure genuineness in belief in Jesus? That's the fundamental question, Jew or Gentile. When one puts the entirety of the story together, with its culmination resting in Jesus, there are now implications that I have to do business with. And genuine belief lives by those implications. I have a new acronym. It's LIBBY, living by implication. What do the things that Jesus said and did, and all that that means, imply in what I am faced with right now, whatever it is that I'm faced with? And this is exactly what James has been going on about. James would say, genuine belief in Jesus implies that I trust God in everything. Genuine belief in Jesus implies that I treat people with kindness. Genuine belief in Jesus implies that I treat people the same. Genuine belief in Jesus implies that I love people who believe what I believe. Genuine belief in Jesus implies that I care for brothers and sisters who have no means to meet their needs on their own. Genuine belief in Jesus implies that I care about purity and honor and humility. Genuine belief in Jesus implies that I bridle my tongue. And genuine belief in Jesus implies that I live in contentment, not coveting what I do not have. It is all of those implications, that is the different do, that seems to me that James is addressing. The non-believing Jew has no implications of Jesus. The believing Jew and the believing Gentile has every implication of Jesus. And that is how one tests one's genuineness, if they live by those implications. Are you or are you not living by the implication of what you believe, the implication of Jesus. If you are not, then you are no believer at all, and nor am I. This, I think, is what James is speaking into in the background with which his audience is working. If we don't know that, it seems to me that we have little hope of understanding what James or any New Testament author is saying. So with that, I read. I'm in James chapter 2, 14. What benefit, my brothers, if someone says he has belief, but he does not have practice? Such belief is not able to save him. If a brother or sister is naked and lacking daily food, but someone from you should say to them, "You, go in peace, you keep warm and eat well," but you do not give them what's necessary for their body, what good is that? So also, belief, if it has no practice, is dead by itself. But if someone will say, "You have belief and I have works," you make known to me your belief apart from your works, and I will make known to you my belief from my works. You believe that God is one? Yeah, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you wish to know, O man, O vain man, that belief apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works, having offered up Isaac, his son, upon the altar? You see that belief was working in tandem with his works, and from the works, belief was brought to its goal. Indeed, the scriptures were fulfilled, having said, "But Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness," justifiedness, "and he was called a friend of God." You see that from works, a man is justified, and not only from belief. And also, was not Rahab the prostitute justified by works, having welcomed in the messengers and having provided them another way out? As the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also belief apart from works is dead. I'm guessing that if you're anything like me, part of that passage is really troubling, because in some ways it goes against everything we've all been taught, that it is not from works that we are saved, but rather from faith, right? That's what the reformers told us. And it sure looks like James is saying something totally different. And as a side note, as a teeny bit of review, you might remember that's precisely why Luther decided James couldn't possibly be part of the Bible, because it went against everything the Bible had already said. In particular, it went against what Romans had said, that it is faith that saves, not works. And I think that's a little bit why I felt like I had to really try to get my head around what was behind everything, because that face value, that does not make sense. So working through the text then, this first part I think is incredibly tricky, and we need to understand what James is saying here in order to make sense of what he means by Abraham and Rahab and others, and anybody else for that matter, being saved by works. So verse 14, what benefit, my brothers, someone says he has belief, but he does not have practice. Such belief is not able to save him. So we need to get off on the right foot. The question, I don't think, or let me say it this way, the question is not, what sorts of good things are you doing? Or what sorts of things are you doing for good? That seems to be the temptation here. At least for me, the initial response to this is, okay, this is asking me, am I doing good things or am I not doing good things? Because Christians do good things. I don't think that is the question here. The question is, are you actually doing what your beliefs imply? It's not, are you doing good things? It's, are you doing what your belief implies? If not, he says, then there really is no belief. And in the matter that James actually cares about, there's no salvation. That's the promise of blessing by way of mercy. So to illustrate this, he gives an example. And it is just that. It's an example. It's not the test per se. If a brother or sister is naked and lacking daily food, I'll go to 16 as well, but someone from you should say to them, "Go in peace, keep warm, eat well," but you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what good is that? This is so tricky. This, I think, is not a test of belief, that James is speaking to above. Rather, it is a dramatic way to drive home his point of how useless it is for one to claim a belief without a corresponding response. So let me paraphrase. I can't say for sure this is what James was saying. This is how I would say what James is just saying in these two verses. So this is the RLR paraphrase. Let's say, James speaking, right here in our little Jewish community, where literally everyone knows everyone, that one of those you know comes to your door without food or clothing, starving and naked. There is not a person here, James would say, who would suggest that your beliefs would not require that you give them something to cover themselves and to eat. The implications of what you believe are that you should act on what you see and what you know. But instead, you've chosen to utterly ignore what's standing right in front of you. In fact, you're actually mocking them. Shalom to you. May your naked body be warm and your empty stomach be filled. In what possible way could that be good? The implication of the naked and hungry brother is that you're to feed and to clothe them. The nakedness and the emptiness are akin to what one says he or she believes. You see they're naked and they're starving. You believe that they have a problem. What do you do? Whether one does or does not act is the question of good or no good. I have always just assumed that this passage is saying that Christians should be on about feeding hungry people and clothing naked people. And that may be true, that's what Christians should do, but that's not what James is saying, I don't think. James is saying, are you acting on your belief or not? And he's using this example to illustrate what it would look like to act on your belief, but he's not defining what their belief should make them do. Let me go on. Notice in verse 17, he says, so also, so he's comparing and contrasting, I think, so also belief, just like that example that I just gave you, well, just like that, belief, if it has no practice, it's dead, dead by itself. James is using this as a comparison and not the actual fulfillment of the belief that James has just been talking about. In exactly the same way, he says, what good could possibly come from saying that you believe in all that God has said, and now Jesus and his Messiah has said, what good is it if you say you believe it and you're not acting on it? You're not acting on what it implies. Where's the good in that? What happens from that? Nothing happens from that. Again, he says, you are not living, or are you living, by the implications of what you say you believe. No living by implication, no belief, no good. This seems to me to be a huge deal. Because aren't we normally hearing that what matters is whether people are clothed and hungry people are fed? Seems to me that's the fundamental question that gets asked all the time. Are we solving the world's problems? Not do you believe? Which actually what James is saying is what determines whether you're saved or not is whether you believe. So it seems to me to be a tremendously important question and distinction. James is not saying, I would argue, that clothing the naked and feeding the hungry are what's ultimately important. Although he would say it is important to do that. In fact, it's part of the law, part of the Torah that they were given. In fact, it's part of the chapter that they're in Leviticus 19. But that's not actually what he's referring to. He's only using that example as a way to drive home his point, his important point of belief. His question is not, are you clothing the naked and feeding the hungry? That's not his question. His question is, can belief save you when that belief does not translate into action? Actions by implication of what you say you believe. That's the question. And although the action is in view, the fundamental question is belief. Do I or don't I believe? But our culture, at least it seems to me, is placing the value merely on the outcome. The belief is not ever even in question. Or said another way, no thought is given as to why, really, one would even choose to feed the hungry and clothe the naked. It's not very likely that that happens when it is happening in view of the profound gratitude and thankfulness towards God for what he's provided me. I'm just doing it because that's what it's supposed to do to look good. I'm doing it as a living proof text that I am worthy to be given residence in the kingdom of God. Subtle, but profoundly different. And there's a trap here that I think that we fall into, and it's a scary trap. The trap is the assumption, just the normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill assumption that I believe. I ask Jesus into my heart, right? So I believe. So now I am simply looking for things to do to be able to say that I practice, not as a measure or an indicator of whether I actually believe, but it is a measure of whether I am a good Christian or not. If I don't practice, well, I'm just a lousy Christian. Belief is not even in view, nor is the question, what would God actually have me do? It's something very different. Maybe you have not heard that or struggled with that, but that has been the story, the entire story of my early Christian life. It seems important to me in this section and in any other section that we read that what we are to remember, or what the question is that's at hand, is do you have belief? The question is not, do you have practice? James would certainly not say that anyone who practices is a believer. He does say, however, that anyone who is a believer practices. That's different. Really, really different. Verse 18. But someone will say, you have belief, and I have works. I tell you what, he says, you make known to me your belief apart from works, and I will make known to you my belief from my works. So James is anticipating a retort. Maybe he actually heard it. And that retort would be, well, I believe. What are you going to do about it? Who's challenging me to say that I don't believe? I believe. And James, I think, is very clever. He says, well, I tell you what. Let's have a little contest. It's a belief contest. Whoever actually has belief wins. And let's invite in the judges. Judges, we need you to determine belief. Is there or is there not belief? We both say we have belief. There are some things that I'm going to do as a result of what I say I believe. Implications, as it were. He's just going to tell you he believes. That's it. Who wins? This is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but we've seen something like this before in Matthew, as probably in the other Gospels. I didn't look. Let me just quickly read this for you. I have time to do it. Matthew 9, 1 through 7, and says, this is Jesus getting into a boat. He came over and he came into his own city, and behold, there were bringing to him a paralytic lying on a bed. Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralytic, take courage, my son, your sins are forgiven. And behold, some of the scribes said to themselves, this fellow blasphemes. And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, why are you thinking evil in your hearts? For which is easier to say, your sins are forgiven, or rise and walk? But in order that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he says to the paralytic, rise, take up your bed, go home. And he rose and he went home. It's a fascinating passage, and we could probably spend some time studying it. And if we're not careful, if we're looking at this passage, what we might think is that the central point is that Jesus is healing the lame, that Jesus came to make things better, clothe the naked, and feed the hungry, right? But that's not what Jesus came to do, and it's not what he came to demonstrate. He came to demonstrate over and over again, as it happens in this particular case by raising a person who couldn't walk, he was doing that to prove he was the anointed one, the Messiah. That's what was upsetting all the people. They never thought anybody like him could be the Messiah. But the point here and the relationship to James is that to demonstrate what one could only know on the inside, that is, in Jesus' case, I am who I say I am, and us, or the Jesus-believing Jew, I believe what I say I believe is actually the case. Jesus acts out on that internal reality and heals the guy as evidence for what is true on the inside. As relates to James, the healing was effectively Jesus working. Now, clearly, we're not working to demonstrate that we're the Messiah. But what James is driving at is that what we say is true on the inside can only be known by actually what occurs on the outside, living by implication. James says rhetorically here, you say you have belief. There is one and only one way to know whether that's true or not. Do you or do you not live by the implications of what you say you believe? Notice what James is centering on here. He says, I will show you faith by works. The question is whether he has faith or not. It just so happens that the works are able to validate the faith. The question is not, do you have works? Not exactly. Rather, it is, do you have faith? And if so, faith works. And it is those works that speak to your faith. Verse 19, you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. This is a super interesting comment. The demons really do believe. I don't actually really know what demons even are. Maybe some of you do. I don't know that it really matters. They're the bad guys, for sure. And they probably had a little better idea about what, I don't know if it matters. The demons really do believe, except that what they believe is that God is God. I think that's what they believe. God is one, God is God, God is the creator, something along those lines. But clearly, that's not the belief that James is speaking to, because nobody thinks that demons are going to be saved. At least I don't think anybody thinks that. And certainly, demons, whatever or whoever they are not living by the implications of what they believe. Arguably, they live at odds with their belief, and they won't be saved. So James is not speaking to some sort of intellectual assent, acknowledging that God is God or even that Jesus is Messiah. He's speaking to a fundamental shift of the heart that cannot help but respond in the same manner that one has been responded to. One cannot help but respond in the same manner that one has been responded to by God. A heart that requires that one live by implication of what that heart now believes to be true. Verse 20, he says, but you wish to know, O vain man, that belief apart from works is dead or useless. Or paraphrase, you need proof, you arrogant SOB. Here's proof. This is tricky because now we're going to start talking about Abraham, and probably the right thing to do is go back and look at that story. And if I remember right, I think, Ron, you did a little ditty on Abraham in when you were teaching James. So you should all dredge up Ron's recording on this part of James, and you can learn more than I'm going to tell you about Abraham. But I will go so far as to read the passage here and give you just a little bit. Nearly all of you, I'm certain, know the story. So let's start there very quickly and what ultimately James is referring to. So Abraham, that I mentioned before, from the Ur of Chaldees, no Jewish person, no believer, some guy in the middle of absolutely nowhere, is called out of nowhere to come basically begin what we now know as the nation of Israel. And he's asked to do a number of things, and he's told that a bunch of stuff is going to happen, and all that stuff does happen. And the primary thing, though, that promised is that through him, a nation is going to be built, that nation we now know, Israel. And God says that's going to happen through an individual person, your son. And as you know, the long time goes on, and that son never, well, one son shows up, but it's not the one that God had intended. And so finally, the son does show up miraculously in many respects to Abraham and Sarah. That son, Abraham, Isaac, is the son, the promised son. And so Isaac finally shows up, the promised son, the son through which everything that God has promised is going to occur, and everybody's happy, especially Abraham. And God says, Abraham, got a little something for you to do. I need you to take Isaac and sacrifice him, which this is why we should probably spend some time talking about this story, but we're not going to. That's a bizarre request. And one, as a father anyway, no, no, no. But Abraham does. At least he agrees to go do that. He takes a bag of sticks and tells his servants to stay behind and goes up probably to Mount Moriah. Well, it was Mount Moriah, but what we would today know as Temple Mount, and agrees to sacrifice his son. And the question that we, why sacrifice, and would God have actually ever had him do that, and isn't that against the law anyway? And there's a whole host of things that we should come to grips with about that, which we're not going to tonight. But the thing that James wants to drive, the point that he wants to drive home, and the important thing for us to know is that Abraham was so convinced, so utterly convinced that God would do what God said he would, however it was that he would do it, that he was willing to take his own son's life because that's what he believed God asked him to do. He was so sold out to what God's promises meant to him that he'd do anything he asked because he believed that God would fulfill his promises. He acted on the implications of what he believed, and the implications were to sacrifice his son. The trouble is, the exegetical trouble is, that, and we're going to read it in a minute, but what the passage says is that God makes all these promises to Abraham. It's in Genesis 15. Bless you, bless all those around you. Your descendants will be as many as stars are in the sky. It's going to go super good for you. It's going to be great. It's going to have a country. It's going to be awesome. And it says that Abraham believed him and it was reckoned to him as righteousness right there. Well, it sure sounds like a belief right there is all took, and Abraham was reckoned as righteous. But we're talking about something very different later on, that it was actually when Abraham takes his son up to the altar, working on that belief, that James wants to suggest reckoned him as righteousness. At least I think that's what he's saying. So we have to figure that out, because they look like they're at odds with each other. And especially if you're well-versed in the book of Romans, you know that if you take the two verses here and one in Romans, they're diametrically opposed. One says it's belief that saves, and the other says it's work that saves, and that's a problem. So we need to figure that out. Genesis 15:6 says, as I mentioned, then he believed in the Lord, or Yahweh, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Of course, this is, as I already said, a fascinating passage, and it's also, I think, an interesting bit of study in language, because the passage clearly says that Abraham believed and it was reckoned to him as righteous. So one could certainly say, it seems to me, that belief is what saved Abraham. That's what Paul says too, by the way. However, as the story goes, Abraham believed that God was going to keep his promises of establishing a great nation through him, and in spite of the fact that killing his son, as God had asked him to do, would seemingly stand squarely in the way of that promise, Abraham did exactly what God asked, believing that God will fulfill his promise. So Abraham, I think, lived by the implications of what he believed. And I would argue it's the most difficult living by implication that ever has occurred. And what James is recognizing, for the sake of his audience, and the circumstances that they're facing, is that Abraham got to the place where God was clearly asking him to live by the implications of what he said he believed, and he did it. And if he didn't do it, James would say, if he didn't live by the implications of what he said he believed, then he would have no belief at all, and none of the promises would have been fulfilled. So, was it that he believed God, or was it that as a believer, he was prepared to do anything God had asked? It appears that the belief that actually saved Abraham was belief that simply did what God had asked. That's the belief that was reckoned to him as righteousness, I think. Living implication of what he said he believed. You see, he says in verse 22, that belief was working in tandem with his works. And from it, or out of it, or by those works, belief was brought to its goal. Belief brought to its telos. Belief necessarily results in responding to the voice of God. Abraham heard a voice, a real voice, I think, and we most likely will only read the voice. And what was the goal, the telos, that believing has and is? It is actually living in the light of the way I say I believe. Doing, living by implication. Or in today's lingos, It's walking the talk. The telos, the point, the conclusion, the end game of belief is capital letters, being a follower of God. One cannot believe and not be. There's more to say about that ultimate goal, for sure. It's called the kingdom of God, but I don't think that's what James has in mind right here. He's talking about being. Verse 23, indeed the scriptures were fulfilled, having said, but Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him as righteousness, justifiedness, dikaiosune, and he was called a friend of God. Scripture being fulfilled is just a way, I think, of saying that scripture played itself out and validated what it is that the entire story is trying to bear out, that those that respond rightly to God are those who will be granted mercy and will be called friends of God. I'm not sure it's any more complicated than that. I'm not sure it's any more involved than that. Scripture bearing itself out. Verse 24, you see then that works justifies a man, and not only from belief. Now, if you don't know what James is driving at, and you haven't had this very helpful conversation that we've all just had for the last 50 minutes, if you didn't know that, you'd read that statement and you'd say, no, no, that doesn't make any sense. I don't see that from works a man is justified, and not only from belief. The casual glance says, no, no, the scripture says Abraham believed. And belief is what saves the man, not the works. But we have to understand the flow. And yes, there is a flow, like I've been saying, to the James's argument. He has correctly observed that what the scripture means by believing is that something is happening. And it is the happening that demonstrates the belief, and consequently one is saved. If we were not fighting this with our reformer's gloves on, this would make total sense, I think. But we are so afraid of falling into the trap of legalism that we just don't know how to say with a straight face that works matter. But in fact, works are critical. But works, as I understand it, only means that we do what God has given us to do. We live by the implications of what we say we believe. And it would be hard for me to imagine disagreeing with that. But maybe you do. Last couple of verses. Story of Rahab. Verse 25, and was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works, having welcomed in the messengers and having provided them another way out? We should go read the story. We won't. I'll just spare you and give you the quick version. Children of Israel have decided, Jericho, right? Help me out. Yeah, thank you. I did read it. I said, remember, children of Israel are getting ready to go in and take the city of Jericho, and they send some spies in to figure out how they're going to take this city. The city's incredibly fortified, not much hope of anybody getting into it. And the two spies, I think there was two of them, come in, and they end up meeting up with Rahab, this prostitute. And again, long story short, they ask her ultimately for her help. And ultimately, she decides to give them her help at risk of losing her life. Had she been found out, she's a dead woman. And so, again, long story short, here comes the children of Israel. She ends up helping them out, helping the spies get out of harm's way, and she's rewarded for that. The fascinating thing about Rahab is Rahab didn't know anything. Rahab was a Canaanite polytheist prostitute. She didn't know squat. She had no law she was living. She was no rule she was following. She didn't know God from whoever. And yet, so Rahab, the prostitute, just like Abraham, I would argue, a little different scenario, clearly, but Rahab was faced with a question, in her case, observing what she'd seen going on with the children of Israel, that this God that they worshipped, this God that was in charge of them, was a pretty big deal, and it made sense to side with him. And so without knowing anything at all about what it meant to be a person who believed in Yahweh, she believed that it made a whole lot of sense to do what it appeared made sense for someone who believed in that God to do, help the people of God. Rahab doing what belief in her case clearly required, and at the risk of death. She knew nothing of faith. She knew nothing of God. She knew nothing of what God had said to do or to don't do. She wasn't even visited by God to ask or to tell her to do something. She was saving her own rear end is what she was doing. And yet, James decides that it was Rahab acting on what she believed that was what ultimately saved her. She was living by the implications of what she believed. Verse 26, as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also belief apart from works is dead. It's a repeat mostly of verse 17, so also belief, if it has no practice, is dead by itself. The connection, it seems to me, that the body is what houses the spirit, which is who the person actually is. Faith is as the body. So faith is as the body and houses the works, the acts, the action, which is who faith really is. Who you are is determined by what you do, not by what you say you will do. And the last thing I want to say about this, and I purposefully only left a couple of minutes for questions, just joking. If I'm right about this whole implication thing, then it seems to me that one has to know from where to draw the implications. In other words, when Jesus arrives and he does all the stuff that he does and says all the things that he says, we got to know the backdrop. We got to know the backstory. We got to know all of the stuff that Jesus is, or maybe not all of it, but a good deal of it, most of it, the premises upon which one would even draw any implications. The story that Jesus is walking himself into. We need to know that. We need to know all of it. And it sort of dawned on me this week, that's why it makes all the sense in the world to me to obsess over what the heck all of this means. Covenants and kingdoms and visions and prophecies and blessings and curses and destruction and reward. It is every one of these things that Jesus arrives with that's all hovering in the background. And it is with every one of these things that Jesus has in mind when he speaks. And if we don't know that, if we don't understand that, if we don't care about that, how would we ever know what the implications are? I don't think we ever would. And the most important part of that, how would we ever, ever live rightly by those implications? We wouldn't know what the implications are. That's it. Questions, comments, or rebukes?
Thanks, Rusty. Hi. I really appreciate how you've treated this, and I think it was really helpful to hear the idea of belief, the works being just working out of the implications of the belief that you have. That was really helpful. I was a little surprised by what you just said at the end about how important the knowledge is, even though I agree with you, because of what you had just said about Rahab, how she didn't know anything. So how are you reconciling those two things?
Well, I thought about that. They are somewhat at odds with each other. As that story plays out, I'm assuming Rahab learned all of that too. And so I'm quite convinced that she would have ultimately been able to live by those implications as well. Can we, just like Rahab, know nothing and get it right? Sure. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think God overcome anybody's ignorance if he needs to. But I think if what I understand the New Testament authors to be saying, in particular James to be saying, and what Jesus is saying, there is a whole backdrop that maybe what I should have said is, to give us our best shot at understanding what all that means, it would be helpful to know as much as we could possibly know. So, for instance, if Rahab had all that story, she'd be in a lot better place to make a decision than she ultimately was, as we are in a better position to make a decision by knowing as much of the story as possible. But is it a requirement to know the whole story in terms of being saved or not? No. I don't think anybody could say that. But would one and should one want to know the whole story? Absolutely. And I think it is certainly the case as Jesus believers to not have that background and to know that story. I think we're lost. Well, I know we are. Look around. Look at the stuff that people have come up with, not knowing the story. So is it ultimately necessary? No, clearly not. Well, Abraham's another just as good of an example, really. I mean, he didn't know anything either. And yet, I'm pretty sure he's going to be in the kingdom. So, yeah, that was probably overstated as a necessity to know the whole story. But as something utterly helpful and meaningful, that was what I probably should have said.
Thanks. Yeah, it seems a lot like what James is saying, which is if you have real belief, it's going to manifest itself in this certain outward expression. And it seems like what you're saying is learning as much as you can about the Bible is probably one of those outward expressions.
Probably not a bad idea.
Yeah. Thanks.
It seems to me that part of the context here is a community immersed in the law.
I think so.
None of what he's talking about is acts of the law.
That's right.
It's all person to person. It's all from your heart to another person who has a heart. And he doesn't say, go back and be a better Jew.
No.
To prove your faith. And he tells the new Jew that has come into this messianic cult, he doesn't say, be a harder Jew. He says, love your neighbor the way God loves you. And it cuts through the attempt to hang around Jesus' house, but not taking the risk of going in. You can claim to be a big fan of Jesus, and you can claim to be part of this new movement. But the rich young ruler said, what must I do? And Jesus didn't quote the law. He said, give up your life and follow me. And so all the works, none of the works in James's mind have anything to do with the law. And I think that's significant. That may have actually been part of the issue, maybe.
Yeah, I think I'm tracking with you. But I certainly don't think, and I'm pretty sure I said, if anyone were to ask James, by the way, should we do what the law says? Well, of course. I think he would have said, of course. I have a challenge for you all this week. Try it. Ask yourself, this happened to me on Thursday. I won't bore you with the story, but I had a situation, which is always happens to me. Every stinking time this stuff makes sense to me, then I get asked the question. But try it. You're faced with a situation, and it will happen. And ask yourself the question, will I or will I not live by the implications right now of what I say I believe? It is a humbling, striking, challenging experience. And for some reason, those words for me, the implication of what I believe, makes so much more sense than just, well, what would Jesus do? That's probably a legitimate question. But for me, I say I believe something in this situation right now. Am I going to live by the implications of what I just said I believe? Am I or am I not? It's a little scary. Try it. I'll ask you next week how it went. Thank you.